the White House announced a new set of immigration restrictions that immediately raised questions. The policy blocks immigration benefits from 19 countries and presents the decision as a response to rising security concerns. At first glance, the message is simple. It was framed as protection. It was framed as caution. It was framed as a necessary step in a tense moment. But once you sit with the list, something does not add up. The pattern is not about terrorism, global risk, or organized threats. It is about who these countries represent and who they do not. People are hearing the number 19 without looking at the names. When you go down the list, you don't find nations tied to the large-scale attacks Americans fear. You find places with low migration numbers and almost no political footprint in the United States. You find communities that rarely appear in national headlines and rarely have anyone in Washington speaking on their behalf. That is what set off my reaction, because the logic behind this announcement does not match the countries being targeted. The policy arrived only days after a shooting near the Capitol where two National Guard members were injured. The suspect had ties to Afghanistan. It was the first major violent incident of the year involving a foreign national. The moment created a clear path for the administration to act. It created a storyline that could support quick policy. It created the environment needed to justify a broad restriction, even if the reasoning did not truly apply to all 19 countries. The timing was not random, it was an opportunity. From an optics standpoint, Afghanistan was the easiest name on the list. It carried the weight of two decades of war and 20 years of American media framing. It required almost no explanation. The public has been conditioned to associate Afghanistan with instability and danger, so placing it at the top of the list allowed the administration to present the rest of the countries as if they belonged in the same category. It gave political cover to a decision that extended far beyond one incident. But the pattern does not hold once you move past Afghanistan. When you read through the remaining 18 countries, you do not find a consistent record of attacks on the United States. You do not find large immigration waves creating national strain. You do not find data that places these nations at the center of organized threats. What you find is something else. You find small countries with limited global influence. You find populations with low migration numbers. You find communities with almost no political representation inside the United States. That is why the list raises questions. Afghanistan explains itself in the current news cycle. The other countries do not. The reasoning becomes less about danger and more about vulnerability. These are places where people lack the ability to challenge a policy decision. These are communities without large lobbying groups, without national advocacy organizations, and without political power in Washington. It is easier to restrict immigration from a country when no one with influence stands in the way. This is the context the public does not see, because the announcement was presented as a uniform response to security concerns. A single explanation applied to 19 nations with different histories, different populations, and different relationships to the United States. When a policy treats them as interchangeable, it becomes reasonable to question whether safety is the driving force or whether the moment was used to advance a broader objective. The inclusion of Afghanistan may have been shaped by headlines. The inclusion of the other 18 suggests something more intentional. The deeper concern is not the announcement itself, but the pattern behind it. These are not countries with strong diplomatic leverage. They are not countries with wealthy diasporas that can influence elections or shape media coverage. Many of these communities live at the edge of American visibility. Their stories do not trend. Their issues do not interrupt the news cycle. When a government moves against groups like that, it rarely meets resistance. It rarely faces pressure. It rarely has to justify itself. This is why the public needs more than a headline. Policies of this scale do not appear overnight. They are built slowly, tested quietly, and released in moments when people are not prepared to question the details. What looks like a security response may be part of a larger shift in how the country defines belonging. What is framed as caution may be something closer to exclusion. And once a list like this is accepted without scrutiny, it becomes easier to expand it. it becomes easier to restrict other populations that lack the power to speak for themselves. If the official explanation only makes sense for one country on the list, what explains the other 18? Because policy decisions do not happen in a vacuum. They happen in a political environment, and they reveal what a government is willing to do when people are not looking closely. When the White House released a list of 19 restricted countries, the announcement came with the language people are accustomed to hearing: national security, elevated risk, stronger screening. These phrases presented the policy as a technical update rather than a major shift in who the United States is now willing to accept. But once you move past the language and focus on the pattern, the logic begins to separate from the narrative. The decision stops looking like a uniform response to danger and starts looking like a strategic selection of countries with minimal power to challenge the decision. The list includes Afghanistan, Cuba, Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Syria, Yemen, Myanmar, Haiti, Eritrea, Sudan, South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Guinea, Equatorial Guinea, Kyrgyzstan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. These nations are not grouped by a shared conflict. They are not geographically aligned. They do not share political systems or migration trends. What they share instead is something quieter: low global influence, limited political representation in the United States, and populations that rarely appear in national conversations unless something has gone wrong. Security risk is the stated justification, but security does not explain the diversity of the list. When you break it down country by country, you do not find 19 nations with a record of large-scale attacks on the United States. You find places with historically small migration numbers, limited access to American institutions, and almost no lobbying presence in Washington. You find countries where citizens cannot mount a coordinated challenge, where media coverage is minimal, and where deportation or restriction does not spark a national debate. The absence of political resistance becomes the most consistent feature across the entire list. This is where the numbers matter. Immigration trends from these countries remain low compared to the rest of the world. Over the last decade, legal entries from Turkmenistan have remained in the low hundreds annually. Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan sit slightly higher, but still represent a fraction of global migration. Countries such as Guinea, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and Eritrea send far fewer migrants than Latin America or East Asia. Haiti stands out only because of recurring instability, but even then, the overall numbers do not justify a sweeping national security claim. The same is true for the Middle Eastern countries on the list. Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen are framed as high risk because of regional conflict, yet documented entries from these countries have been tightly controlled for years. Most visas issued to citizens of these nations fall under family reunification, academic study, or humanitarian protection. When you examine the data, you do not see a surge that warrants an emergency measure. You see a slow and consistent pattern of migration that the United States has already managed under existing laws. What emerges from the breakdown is a structure that relies on public perception rather than measurable threat. These countries carry the image of instability, even when their migration impact is statistically small. They are associated with conflict, even when their citizens pose no demonstrated risk. They are distant enough that few Americans can challenge the narrative. The policy uses that distance as cover. It uses public unfamiliarity as justification. It uses the idea of danger rather than the evidence of it. This is the part where the list begins to reveal its real design. These are not countries with powerful diasporas capable of shaping elections. These are not countries with economic leverage over the United States. They are not countries that can threaten trade, energy, or diplomacy. Instead, they represent the margins. They represent people who can be restricted without a national conversation. They represent communities that do not have anchors in Congress or advocates on television. That absence of power creates an opening. It creates a policy space where decisions can be made with minimal resistance. The selection becomes even clearer when you consider who is not on the list. Nations with active extremist networks are missing. Countries linked to previous attacks are absent. Nations with larger undocumented populations are not included. The omissions say as much as the inclusions. The list is not a picture of global threat. It is a picture of political calculus. It targets places where pushback is unlikely and where the public has limited context. It is a list designed to appear decisive without confronting the countries that would create diplomatic consequences. This is why the 19-country restriction cannot be understood as a straightforward safety measure. It must be understood as a structural decision shaped by optics, timing, and vulnerability. It is a policy that draws power from silence. It is a policy that expects limited debate. And it is a policy that uses one incident to justify an action that reaches far beyond that moment. The systemic pattern is clear once the surface is removed. The list does not reflect danger. It reflects opportunity. It reflects an administration that understands which communities can be restricted with minimal political cost. And it reflects a deeper shift in immigration policy where the measure of belonging is not based on threat, legality, or contribution. It is based on how loudly your community can respond when the government decides you no longer have a place. When you begin looking at the numbers behind these 19 countries, the entire announcement starts to take on a different form. What was presented as a national security measure becomes harder to defend once you lay out the data across the last 5, 10, or even 20 years. The policy is positioned as a response to elevated risk, yet the measurable impact of migration from these countries tells a very different story. It reveals communities that are small, dispersed, and statistically insignificant compared to the larger immigration trends shaping the country. It also exposes a gap between public perception and the reality of who is actually arriving in the United States. The clearest place to start is with immigration volume. Over the last decade, the United States has recorded millions of entries through family reunification, employment visas, student visas, and refugee programs. Yet the combined total of immigrants from many of the restricted nations barely registers as a fraction of national movement. Countries such as Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, Eritrea, and Equatorial Guinea account for only a few hundred to a few thousand entrants per year. Some years, the numbers fall below 1,000. These are not countries contributing to any form of mass migration. They are not shaping labor markets. They are not altering demographic patterns. They are small communities whose presence barely affects census statistics. When the numbers are this low, the question becomes simple. What threat does a nation represent when fewer than 1,000 of its citizens enter the United States each year and almost all arrive through legal channels? The answer is that the threat is symbolic rather than factual. It is built on public unfamiliarity, not measurable danger. It is built on historical associations, not present-day realities. And it is built on a political calculation that the public will not look deeper than the headline. The countries with larger migration numbers still do not match the framing. Haiti has historically had a stronger presence due to natural disasters, political instability, and family-based immigration. Yet Haitian immigrants overwhelmingly fall under standard legal pathways. Many have resided in the United States for decades. A significant portion are lawful permanent residents. Others hold temporary protected status due to earthquakes and hurricanes that destroyed infrastructure and made safe return impossible. When you evaluate Haitian migration through a security lens, the numbers do not support the claim. There is no evidence linking Haitian migration to elevated risk. There is no pattern of violence targeting the United States. There is only poverty, instability, and a long history of American foreign policy shaping events on the island. The same pattern holds for the African nations on the list. The Democratic Republic of the Congo, Sudan, South Sudan, and Guinea are places where people flee due to civil conflict, famine, or political repression. They arrive primarily through refugee programs that involve some of the longest and strictest vetting procedures in the world. Refugees do not move freely. They go through layers of background checks, interviews, medical screenings, and identity verifications that take years to complete. Removing these countries from the immigration system does not reduce a threat. It blocks survivors of violence who already pose no risk and often bring nothing but the clothes they were able to carry when their homes collapsed. Once again, the numbers tell the story. Congo accounts for roughly 5,000 to 10,000 refugee admissions in peak years. Sudan and South Sudan, even fewer. Guinea remains one of the smallest migrant populations in the country. The people arriving from these nations are primarily families seeking stability. Their communities tend to integrate quietly. They start small businesses. They work service and labor jobs. They send children to local schools. The idea that they represent a coordinated security concern does not appear anywhere in the data. The Middle Eastern countries on the list carry a different public image, but the numbers remain consistent. Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen each have historical conflicts that shape the way Americans perceive them. But perception does not align with the migration reality. Entries from Iran are heavily restricted and have been for decades. Iraqi immigration is dominated by former U.S. allies and interpreters who assisted the military and were promised protection in return. Syrian arrivals have been small since the refugee program was reduced in earlier administrations. Yemeni migration is even smaller, with many arrivals falling under family reunification. These populations are not large enough to justify a 19-country sweeping restriction. They do not match the scale of immigration from Latin America, Asia, or Europe. They do not drive crime rates. They do not strain infrastructure. They do not overrun public systems. What they do is represent people with complex histories whose stories are easy to use politically because the public has limited familiarity with their countries and limited context for their struggles. Impact becomes clearer when you look at what happens inside the United States. Communities from these restricted nations tend to be highly concentrated, often forming small pockets in cities such as Minneapolis, Seattle, Houston, Miami, Los Angeles, and parts of Northern Virginia. Their presence is usually tied to employment chains, educational opportunities, or refugee placement programs. These communities do not hold political influence. Their voting power is minimal. Their local representation is limited. This makes them easy targets. Restricting a group with no national voice does not come with the same political cost as restricting a large organized diaspora. When a government uses immigration policy as a tool of political signaling rather than public safety, people from these countries feel the impact long before the rest of the population notices. Students see their visa approvals stall. Workers see their renewals delayed. Families who have waited years for reunification suddenly discover that the pathway they relied on no longer exists. These decisions create immediate instability. Dreams are interrupted, careers are halted, medical plans collapse, parents remain separated from children, weddings are postponed, entire futures shift overnight. This is the part of immigration policy that rarely makes headlines. The cost is personal long before it becomes visible. A graduate student from Uzbekistan can lose funding because she cannot enter the country. A doctor from the Democratic Republic of the Congo can lose his residency placement because his visa gets denied under a new classification. An elderly parent waiting in Haiti for a family-based petition can be left in limbo indefinitely. These disruptions do not show up on national dashboards, but they fracture lives in ways that cannot be measured in sound bites. The effect extends beyond individuals. When an entire category of countries is restricted, the communities already living in the United States feel an immediate shift. Mosques, community centers, and cultural organizations find themselves navigating fear and confusion. People worry that travel will become impossible. They worry that a visit home will lead to separation at the border. They worry that any documentation error will be treated as a threat rather than a mistake. These concerns grow silently and create emotional pressure that shapes how people work, socialize, and plan for the future. The economic impact is also real. Many of these communities support industries that rely on international professionals and specialized workers. Hospitals rely on physicians from Sudan, Syria, and Iran. Research institutions rely on scientists and scholars from countries such as Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Myanmar. Manufacturing and service industries rely on immigrant labor from Haiti, Guinea, and the Congo. Restricting these countries disrupts sectors that already face shortages. It creates inefficiencies that ripple outward through local economies. The data shows something else too. When countries with small migrant populations are restricted, the message is not about risk. It is about who the government is willing to cut off without political consequence. The administration did not place Mexico on the list, even though undocumented entries from Mexico outnumber the combined migration from all 19 restricted nations many times over. The administration did not restrict Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Nigeria, India, or the Philippines, even though these countries have larger populations and more complex geopolitical histories. Instead, the list reflects a calculation about which populations carry the least ability to challenge the decision. This is where the impact becomes structural. Restricting countries with small communities creates a template. It allows the government to argue that the measure is limited and targeted, even though the reasoning behind it does not align with the data. Once that template is accepted, it becomes easier to expand it. It becomes the basis for future lists. It becomes the justification for broader restrictions. It becomes a form of policy normalization where each decision builds on the last until the public no longer questions the logic. That is why the numbers matter. They show that this decision was not driven by a measurable threat. They show that the list was not shaped by public safety. They show that the communities most affected have the least power. And they show that immigration policy is shifting toward a model where vulnerability becomes the primary determinant of who gets excluded. That is the ground we are standing on now. A policy that looks decisive on paper, but fractures communities that never posed a threat in the first place. A restriction that carries national implications, even though the data does not support the narrative. And an impact that will shape families, careers, and futures for years to come. Cuba's presence on the list changes the entire conversation. It is the one country that immediately signals something deeper than security screening. It disrupts the explanation that the policy is about immediate danger or urgent national threats. Cuba has a unique legal and historical relationship with the United States, shaped not only by the Cold War, but by decades of diplomacy, migration agreements, and humanitarian exceptions. This history makes the new restriction stand out because it ignores the foundation that shaped Cuban immigration for more than half a century. To understand why Cuba does not belong on this list, you have to return to the structure the United States built after the Cuban Revolution. For more than 60 years, U.S. policy has treated Cuban migrants differently from nearly every other group. This was not accidental, it was strategic, it was ideological, it was a central piece of American foreign policy. For decades, Cuban nationals who reached American soil were granted rapid access to legal status because their defection supported the political narrative of communism failing on its own terms. Their arrival was not framed as a burden. It was celebrated as proof of American strength. This is why Cuba has always been an outlier. Even during moments of tense relations, Cuban migrants were not grouped with other nations. They were protected by the Cuban Adjustment Act of 1966, which allowed most Cuban entrants to apply for permanent residency after 1 year. This made Cuban migration one of the most stable, predictable, and legally supported pathways into the country. It also became one of the most effective diplomatic tools the United States used in the Western Hemisphere. That foundation did not disappear when the wet foot, dry foot policy was ended in 2017. The broader structure of legal preference for Cubans still existed. Placing Cuba on a restricted list disregards this entire framework. It takes a country that has been treated as a political exception for generations and reframes it as a national threat with no transition in between. It suggests that the administration is not responding to a credible danger, but rather reshaping immigration policy to remove the groups that cannot easily fight back. Because Cuban Americans have political influence, especially in Florida, but new Cuban migrants do not. The divide between those already here and those trying to arrive has become a lever for political gain. The irony is that the original justification for welcoming Cuban migrants is the same logic that should remove Cuba from this list. If the United States believed for 60 years that Cubans fleeing a communist regime deserve protection, then that logic does not suddenly change because of a new political narrative. The conditions inside Cuba have not improved. The government has not become more democratic. The economy has not stabilized. People are not suddenly safer. If anything, the humanitarian need is more severe now than it was in past decades. This is why Cuba's inclusion feels structural rather than strategic. It does not follow a security logic. It does not follow a migration logic. It follows a political one. It treats Cuban migrants as a symbolic target rather than a real threat. It becomes easier to restrict Cuban entry than to address the unrest, poverty, and repression pushing people to flee in the first place. And in the process, the policy discards the entire historical context that shaped Cuban migration for generations. There's another layer to this. For decades, Cuban immigrants were viewed by the United States as a bridge between nations. They sent remittances home. They supported families. They represented one of the few sources of economic stability for people living inside Cuba. Restricting Cuban immigration does not weaken the Cuban government. It weakens the communities that rely on that support. It reduces the flow of resources that help people survive under a regime that struggles to meet basic needs. It also threatens the future of family reunification. Cuban American communities have multi-generational networks. They rely on a steady process that allows parents, siblings, spouses, and children to build lives together over time. Removing Cuba from that system reshapes thousands of families overnight. People already waiting years for approval may see their cases stalled, reduced, or denied entirely. This creates the same fear seen in other restricted communities, but amplified by the weight of a relationship that was never supposed to be disrupted. What makes Cuba different from the other nations on the list is how clearly its inclusion exposes the underlying logic of the policy. The government cannot claim this is about imminent danger because Cuba has not produced any form of coordinated attack on the United States. It cannot claim this is about migration surges because Cuban arrivals have long been managed under well-established programs. It cannot claim this is about instability because instability in Cuba is not new. It has been a defining part of the relationship for generations. Cuba's presence on the list removes the last pretense of uniform threat. It turns the policy into a signal. It shows that the administration is willing to break decades of precedent to reshape the demographics of future immigration. It suggests that the goal is not to reduce danger, but to regulate who is allowed to enter based on political convenience and public image. This is why Cuba has to be addressed separately. It is not just another name on the list. It is the name that reveals the structure. It is the name that shows the policy is not designed to respond to risk, but to reshape the profile of who can come to the United States at all. When you broaden the lens beyond Cuba and look across all 19 countries, a pattern starts to emerge. The numbers do not show communities presenting a threat. They show the opposite. These countries make up a small percentage of total immigration, yet they carry oversized political weight when placed on a list like this. They represent communities with limited influence in Washington and limited economic leverage in American markets, which makes them easy to target. The data highlights how these restrictions do not reduce national danger. They reshape the demographics of who gets to arrive in the first place. Take Turkmenistan. This is a country that barely registers in high-volume immigration metrics. In most years, the number of Turkmen immigrants arriving in the United States is a fraction of 1% of all legal pathways. These are not large populations overwhelming the system. These are students, spouses, workers, and people seeking stability in a place that offers opportunities unavailable at home. The idea that Turkmen immigrants pose a structural risk does not align with any of the available data. It reflects something else entirely, a A similar pattern exists with Myanmar. The United States has long received small numbers of migrants from Myanmar, many of whom are fleeing political conflict, ethnic violence, and economic hardship. They are more likely to arrive through humanitarian channels than through standard migration programs. Restricting entry from Myanmar does not protect the country. It leaves vulnerable communities with fewer options for safety. The policy frames these groups as potential threats, even though the evidence shows they are more often victims of instability, not drivers of it. The data from African nations on the list follows the same trend. Countries like the Democratic Republic of Congo and Guinea send modest numbers of migrants through legal channels. Many arrive through family reunification or special diversity programs that were built to expand global representation in the immigration system. They are not concentrated in high-risk categories. They do not appear in the profiles that national security experts focus on. Yet, these communities are among the first restricted because they lack organized political influence. Their contribution to American labor, education, and local economies is overlooked because they do not fit into the broader strategic narrative. Haiti is another example where the numbers do not align with the policy. Haitian migrants often arrive through mixed channels. Some come for family reunification, some come through student visas, some arrive through humanitarian pathways tied to natural disasters and political uncertainty. Haiti's presence on the list reflects a decision to restrict a community that already faces barriers to stability. It does not reflect tangible data showing heightened national risk. It reflects how easy it is to limit a population that has few advocates in the policy arena. When you evaluate the numbers across these 19 countries over the last 10 to 20 years, the trend is consistent. These nations do not represent a major share of the immigration pipeline. The flow of entrants is steady, but modest. The occupations represented include service work, small business ownership, healthcare, logistics, and education. These are sectors that rely heavily on immigrant labor and often struggle to find local workers. The policy does not address a documented crisis. It limits populations that have quietly contributed to American communities without drawing attention. There is also the question of accountability. When large-scale policy changes occur, the expectation is that government agencies will present clear evidence to justify the shift. Nothing in the public record suggests a documented surge of risk coming from these countries. There is no series of coordinated events that tie back to these populations. The data does not show elevated crime rates, extremist ties, or public safety concerns among recent entrants. If anything, these groups have lower incident rates because they represent small populations with strong community networks. This context matters because immigration policy is not only about who arrives, it is about who is allowed to build a future. When the government limits entry from countries with low political power, it changes the composition of neighborhoods, workplaces, and future voting districts. It narrows the diversity of experience and culture that has historically shaped the American identity. The impact is gradual and often invisible, but it shapes the long-term character of the country. Another layer emerges when you look at the economic data. Many of the restricted countries send migrants who contribute directly to understaffed industries. They fill gaps in agriculture, transportation, construction, and healthcare. They take positions that keep local economies functioning. Restricting these populations does not reduce competition. It reduces the labor force in places that already face shortages. The decision becomes less about safety and more about reconfiguring the economic landscape in ways that privilege some communities over others. There is also a humanitarian cost. Several of the countries on the list are experiencing active conflict, political repression, or economic collapse. Restricting entry from these nations does not reduce global instability, it deepens it. People who could have reached safety will be forced to remain in environments that threaten their lives. Families who were waiting for approval may now see their futures erased because of a political decision that was justified with broad language rather than specific evidence. When you pull all this together, a clearer picture forms. The 19 countries were not selected because they share a common security profile or because they represent a coordinated threat. They were selected because they share a common vulnerability. they have limited influence. Their migrants do not represent political blocs that can shift elections. Their governments cannot pressure the United States with trade leverage. Their stories rarely make national headlines. These populations are easier to target because they do not have the institutional power to push back. This is why the policy feels less like an act of protection and more like an act of design. The government can reshape the future immigration landscape without facing immediate resistance because the affected communities lack the resources to respond. The data does not support the narrative of danger. It supports a narrative of selective restriction that rewards political convenience and punishes the vulnerable. When immigration policy becomes a tool for political signaling rather than a response to documented needs, the outcome is predictable. The country becomes narrower, the system becomes less fair, and the people caught in the middle pay the price through stalled cases, broken reunification pathways, and the quiet erasure of future opportunities. When you step back and look at the full picture, the policy does not read like a security measure. It reads like an attempt to reduce the future presence of certain communities without saying that directly. The countries selected do not share a common risk profile, and they are not responsible for any recent coordinated threat against the United States. What they share is limited political influence, limited economic leverage, and limited ability to push back when restrictions are placed on them. That is the thread connecting all 19 names. It is the quiet part of the policy that becomes clear once the data, history, and structural changes are placed side by side. It is also clear that the decision was shaped by public optics. The incident involving the shooting of two National Guard members in Washington became the catalyst used to justify the list. Afghanistan appears on the list because the person responsible for that attack could be connected to Afghan nationality in public perception. That connection may not reflect broader statistical patterns, but it becomes an easy narrative bridge. It is the kind of event that can be framed as a wake-up call, even though it does not reflect the behavior of the wider Afghan immigrant population. But once you move beyond Afghanistan, the pattern stops aligning with the stated reason. Cuba does not belong on the list based on any security metric or public threat. Turkmenistan does not belong on the list based on any migration surge or documented danger. Guinea, Haiti, and the Democratic Republic of Congo do not belong on the list based on crime statistics or public safety data. These are populations that have largely arrived through legitimate pathways and contributed to communities that rely on steady immigrant labor. They are not destabilizing forces. They are part of the national fabric. This policy also exposes a deeper issue in how immigration decisions are made. When major restrictions can be placed on entire populations without transparent justification, it signals a shift in how the government views its authority. Instead of evidence-based risk assessment, decisions begin to mirror political narratives. Instead of targeted measures that address real concerns, broad restrictions shape the demographics of who can build a future in the country. The long-term result is a system that becomes less about safety and more about control. The inclusion of Cuba makes this point especially clear. The United States spent 60 years building a unique migration framework around Cuban arrivals. It did this for political reasons, economic reasons, and ideological reasons. Removing Cuba from that pathway disrupts families, breaks legal expectations, and undermines a foundation that has shaped American identity in cities from Miami to Tampa to Houston. When you can discard that legacy without presenting new evidence, it raises questions about what other long-standing principles can be removed for convenience. There is also a larger ethical question. Should immigration policy be used to punish communities that are already facing instability and limited options at home? Countries on the list include places with political unrest, limited healthcare, economic collapse, and weak infrastructure. Restricting entry from these nations does not improve global stability. It leaves people in environments where survival is already difficult. when the government limits entry from vulnerable populations without explaining why, the decision begins to resemble selective exclusion, not national protection. What happens next will depend on how the public responds. If the narrative remains focused on headlines and isolated incidents, the policy may be accepted without scrutiny. If the conversation shifts toward evidence, historical context, and the lived impact on families, the flaws become harder to ignore. Immigration debates often rely on emotional triggers, but the long-term consequences are structural. They determine who becomes part of the American story and who remains outside the gates. The future question is whether this policy stays temporary or becomes the blueprint for something larger. When you create a list of 19 nations based on limited justification, you establish a precedent that can be expanded. More countries can be added. More pathways can be restricted. More communities can be framed as threats without presenting new evidence. Once the doorway is opened, it becomes easier for future administrations to shape immigration around political convenience instead of national interest. There is also a risk that selective restrictions deepen divisions within American society. Immigrant communities that have lived here for decades may now feel their futures are less secure. People who were preparing to reunite with family may see those plans fall apart overnight. Workers who depend on visas from these countries may face new barriers that threaten their stability. When you disrupt immigration flows from 19 nations, the ripple effects reach far beyond the border. They reshape neighborhoods, economies, and local systems that rely on predictable pathways. This is why the data matters. When you look at the numbers across the last 10 to 20 years, you do not find a pattern that supports the decision. You find communities building businesses, supporting families, filling essential jobs, and integrating into American life. You find low rates of national security incidents. You find steady but modest immigration flows that do not strain the system. You find people whose presence has strengthened the country rather than endangered it. None of that narrative appears in the justification for these restrictions. The final question is, what kind of immigration system the country wants in the coming decade? If the goal is safety, then the system must be rooted in evidence. If the goal is fairness, then the system must be transparent. If the goal is political advantage, then the system will continue to shift in ways that leave vulnerable communities on the margins. Policies like this make it clear that the future direction is not just about border management. It is about who the country believes deserves entry, opportunity, and protection. The danger is not the arrival of migrants from these 19 nations. The danger is a system that can reclassify entire populations without presenting new evidence and expect people to accept it without question. When that becomes normal, the country moves closer to an immigration landscape shaped by fear rather than fact. And once that structure is in place, it is difficult to reverse. The future depends on whether people recognize that these decisions are not isolated. They are part of a larger design that will shape the character and demographics of the nation long after this administration ends.